friends. Welcome to Mansfield College and to this talk in the series, the Mansfield series, which takes place on a Friday night. And we are very privileged tonight to have, as our guest, Margaret Hodge. I have to tell you all that she's one of my dear friends. We always say, Margaret, that this is the principal's friends lecture series. I've known Margaret for many years, and she is just an extraordinary woman. I knew her when she was, when you were in the council, you were in the Lincoln Council, yeah. But she went on, of course, to become a Member of Parliament. I mean, she was the leader of the council in Islington. She went on to become a Member of Parliament, and then after the 97 election, she held a number of different posts. She was started off, of course, like so many people, as a parliamentary under Secretary of State, and then she was in, at that time, she was in the Department of Education and Employment. She was a minister for disabled people. She moved on to become the first minister for children, and it was she really made that post have meaning and did incredible work in that field. She went on to be the Minister for Work, and then became a Minister for Culture and Tourism. I'm sad to say that her wonderful husband, Henry, who was a great friend and a lawyer and ultimately a judge, became ill, and she stepped down from that post to be with him as he was very seriously ill. And then she returned to that post after Henry died, and she is now in opposition chairing the Public Accounts Committee. My God, was there a job she was meant for? Was there a job that you were meant to have? Because we've all watched and our jaws have dropped in awe and wonder at the job that she's done there. She has been the most fabulous chair of that Public Accounts Committee, and it really has made us feel that select committees really can rattle the bars and actually remind us of what the purpose is of holding power to account. And so it's really wonderful that you've taken time out, Margaret, to come down and be here with us at Mansfield College. And I'm thrilled because you're my pal.
Thank you, Leila. I can do it from here because then I can get at the water and I've got a slight throat. Helena told me to talk for not too long, which I won't do, and then hopefully we can have an exchange of views, which I would very much welcome. I'm just going to really do a rattle around all sorts of experiences I've had over the last 3 years and hope that will stimulate some thoughts among you. First of all, coming to this splendour of an Oxford college reminds me of the splendour of my own room. I've got a room on the upper committee corridor in the Palace of Westminster, which goes with a job. And along one of the walls in the room are all my predecessors. Among them, I was surprised to see Harold Wilson, key chair of the Public Accounts Committee. And when I sort of inquired, why on earth was he doing that job? The story is that in those days, MPs didn't have rooms, and we had those old-fashioned Victorian desks with the attached chairs in the corridors. And the only person to have a room was the chair of the Public Accounts Committee. So he took the room to have, he took the job to have the room. Two other predecessors staring me in the face, both got assassinated. One is Guinness, who got assassinated during the war by, I think, the Jews. It was over the Israeli issue. And the other was Cavendish, who was a victim of the Phoenix Park murders. And I'm waiting for somebody in the tax world, where I'm tax prat of the year, to have a go as me as the third victim. The Public Accounts Committee is always chaired by a member of the opposition, but it reflects the composition of Parliament. So I've got a majority of Conservatives and one Lib Dem on my committee. Until 2010, it was the position of being chair was always in the gift of the whips and the leaders of the parties. I'm the first elected occupant of the post. All my committee are also elected. I was elected by the whole House. It's a really interesting development in constitutional affairs of the UK. And I'm the first woman. It's never been held by a woman before the post. But the interesting thing about the election is I'm elected for 5 years. And having been a minister through most of the Blair Brown years, it feels absolutely wonderful to have the security of tenure of 5 years, which I never had as a minister in any job I did in the past. And it means you really can plan things. You haven't got to do things today because you're worried you're going to be gone tomorrow. You can take a much longer view of how you tackle the whole issues of value for money, efficiency, effectiveness, and economy and public expenditure on the rounds. We are in an interesting phase in the development of select committees, partly because we're all elected. I think that does give us a new independence and authority, so we're taken more seriously, and I think that's welcome. Partly, there's a real attempt by all members of Parliament in the wake of the expensive scandals to really reassert some credibility and confidence in our parliamentary democracy. And partly, and interesting, I don't know if I'm right about this, but my thesis is that because we've got a coalition government, people come into the select committee part of it with far less a partisan approach to how they're going to deal with the issues that they have to tackle. They leave the crude politics at the committee door. It doesn't mean there aren't politics, of course there are, but the crude politics are there. So we've got a much stronger sense of identity in the committees than I think we had before. And it would be very interesting if we go back to a majority parliament, whether that element of the strength of select committees will be sustained. Our job is to look at anything that spends public money. And so we range, it's the most fascinating job. I really feel really privileged. I'm learning about things I never knew anything about, aircraft carriers, defence procurement, things like that, which never reached to touch me before. We've just published a report on DFID and how it tackles malaria. We're looking at the troubled families. We look at the BBC. We're about to publish a report on the BBC. We had a good session yet this week looking at private contractors. I'm going to come back to that and how they deliver public services with G4S, Capita, Atos and Serco, all giving evidence to us. All our reports are unanimous, so we never produce a report that isn't unanimous. It doesn't mean that there isn't a bit of give and take behind the scenes, but they come out as unanimous report. And how do we get there? And I think what is interesting is there is a shared interest in value for money across the political spectrum. If you're on the right of the spectrum, you want better value because you want to have a smaller state and you want to cut taxes and cut public expenditure. I think, and I don't think the left has taken it seriously, but if you're on the left of the spectrum, where you believe in the worth of public expenditure to transform people's life chances, you need to do a job convincing people actually that the money that they sacrifice from their weekly or monthly earnings is used to good effect. So I think it's really important that the left grasps this agenda, particularly at this time when people are feeling it hard times. So that's one thing, we have this shared interest. The other thing is we tend to look backwards, not forwards. That's supposed to be what we do. I've slightly transformed that in that we are looking at some of the big projects like HS2, or we're looking at the universal credit over time. We're taking these big projects. We're now going to start monitoring the Ministry of Justice and what they're doing to the probation services and other services there with the privatisation. So we are taking a much stronger look forwards. And obviously, I think it's a bit pointless just look, being critical of a project that the government has undertaken without thinking about how can they do things differently to improve in the future. All our work is based on National Audit Office reports, and that gives us a basis of fact which people find it very difficult to quarrel with. So, for example, we recently looked at the government's work programme, which is the welfare to work efforts, where they have entirely taken the state out of that, and it's now run by 80 private providers, including the G4Ss and the Circos. And what is interesting is none of these people are sticking to their contracts, meeting their contracts. Indeed, the return, the success rate of people who come through their door and get into work is about 3.5% so far, the last stats that were published, which are probably worse than would have happened if no money at all had been spent. So we're talking about pretty lots of hundreds of millions of pounds going on this one. But Because the facts were there, although it's a politically contentious issue, nevertheless, we managed a unanimous report which was critical of where the government has got so far. And I think that's very helpful. And the other thing is I've been pretty open and attacked Labour's record in government, indeed one or two reports for which I had some ministerial responsibility at some point. But that has helped build my credibility. And I have to tell you, I think the worst story was one of the early stories we had, which was around the aircraft carriers, which is a continuing saga. Very late in the Brown administration, there was a decision taken to build these honking great aircraft carriers, as much for industrial reasons, i.e. to keep jobs going, really, rather than for any good defence purpose. But be that as it may, they signed the contract without any money at all in the budget, should not have been allowed to do so. 18 months later, there wasn't any money in the budget, so they had to delay everything. And the delay for further 18 months cost all of us £1.6 billion. That's a pretty shocking story. And I think for our credibility, for that thing, actually my values, it's something we shouldn't have done. But my being able to be critical of that has enabled me then to build consensus in my committee when I now want to be critical of the record of the coalition of government. The final thing to say to you before I get into a bit more detail is not all our reports are bad. We actually do produce a lot of reports which say government is getting this not too badly wrong, quite well, could do better. And I give you the story of a report I did on 16 to 18 year old education, one of Helena's passions. And we were saying, it was actually looking back on a lot of the record of the Labour government, and it was saying we'd done a lot right, there were areas where we could improve, but on the whole we were moving in the right direction. I get rung up by a researcher on the Today programme who says, will you come on tomorrow to discuss your report? I said, fine. She said, what are you going to say? I said, I'm going to say it's not too bad, could do a little bit better, but actually it's been quite a success. She said, I thought you were going to be critical. I said, no, it's a good report. She said, I better go away and read it. She then goes away and reads it and comes back to me half an hour later and drops me as an item on the Today programme. Now that's a bit about us. I think our work is more important today probably than it has ever been, which is why probably it commands quite a lot of attention in the media. Partly because there are real cuts in public expenditure and they're really impacting on people's living standards, and I think that's hard. Partly because everybody's feeling the pinch and therefore there's a much greater concern that every pound that they give up should provide value. And also, for me, ideologically, the deficit is not going to be dealt with by 2015, and whichever government gets in there will still have to eke money out of it to get into a better balance for the public finances. So we will have to carry on cutting. And it's really important if we do that, that we really get best value for every pound of taxpayers' money we spend, and that we use that to protect the most vulnerable in our community. And our mantra in our committee is we simply follow the taxpayers' pound. It's been a very useful mantra to have, as you'll see. And what have we learned? What have we learned so far? I'm going to talk a little bit about that and then talk a bit about our work on tax. There is a lot of waste. I mean, it's been a bit depressing for me after sort of most of the years of Clare Brown as a minister. When you thought you were doing okay, you knew there were problems, but when you look at the thing in the round across the whole of government, you could actually get more for much less if we were smarter in how we spent our money. And you know, if I tell you that I had one afternoon where we looked at the Ministry of Defence procurement, big projects procurement, and in literally a 2 or 3 hour session, because we get exhausted at the end of 2 or 3 hours of it, we had identified £8 billion of, in effect, torn up pound notes, partly because of delays, partly because people re-specified, partly because there was changes in political priorities, all that sort of stuff, literally leading to that sort of waste. And you look at some major IT projects, the most infamous one is probably the NHS IT, when we tried to get care records shared right across the country. Really good concept in theory. executed in the most appalling way of practice, and in the end abandoned at the cost of, I think, something like £6 billion. And partly when you see things like the BBC payoffs, and you recognise there that there really is not a feeling of responsibility, that you're really dealing with our money, all of our money, and therefore you have to deal with it in a proper way to ensure best value, and it's really being used to benefit. So there is a lot. Why? And yet, people who administer public money, everybody who goes into public service, I say I've been in public service for 40 years, we go in with the best of intents to really make the world a better place. You don't go into public service really to earn money, as in academia is exactly the same. But you get the satisfaction of really interesting problems that you have to deal with, but you also get the satisfaction that you hope that you're making improvements, again, wherever you are on the political spectrum, for a better place. And I think the same goes for the civil service. There are a lot of bright young things coming in, yet somehow the culture and the system doesn't actually use their skills and their abilities to best advantage. We don't have the right skills. I mean, like one of my, you know, if I take the West Coast Main Line, which is a recent disaster, it's a £5.5 billion contract. And yet, what did we do? All the bidders spent about £10 million each on preparing for the bid. We in government only spent £2 million. And when Virgin came to see me, it only took them 10 minutes of talking to me when I realised what a terrible mess and what awful mistakes we'd made in the assessments of those contracts and in the awarding them. It was just stupid, and we just hadn't put the people with the right skills in the right position, and we hadn't spent enough money on assessing what was a very, very big contract. And I've had permanent secretaries in front of me on two, I'll just tell you about two occasions. The government decided to privatise the interpreters' contracts in the courts. They were spending too much on it. They wanted to cut the costs. And instead of cutting the costs, which they could have done, it was a pretty extravagant, they decided the easiest way to do that was to privatise it. They put it out to tender. They get a tender in from this company. They do financial due diligence, which says, don't give this little company more than £1 million business. So they don't. They awarded a £40 million contract. So, of course, on day one, there aren't enough interpreters. The courts, lots of cases have to be adjourned. People are kept in remand. The justice is denied. And it costs an arm and a leg to the MOJ to deal with the inability of us actually to let a sensible contract. Similar one, which absolutely drove me mad, was that we decided, it was an old Labour government decision, that we would privatise the transmission of energy from the offshore wind farms into the grid. I don't know why we decided we'd do it. And here I had this permanent secretary sitting in front of us saying, we've created a market. And then when she described the contract, you were just horrified, because it was that contract that leads to the high consumer bills that we all pay for our energy. It's that sort of a decision that goes wrong. So we had awarded 20-year contracts, although these wind farms in the sea only have a 10-year life. We had assured the income linked to RPI, Retail Price Index, which nothing in government is now linked to that. It's all Cost Price Index. So we'd linked it to that. They got the money whether or not we used the energy. If their pipes broke down, they only lost 10% penalty, and you'd be bonkers not to actually, if you had the infrastructure, bid for such a generous contract that was awarded by this government. So we just don't have the skills. We don't have people in jobs long enough. The way you get promoted in civil service is that you move your jobs every 2 years, whereas we ought to be valuing people for achieving within that job and increasing their status and their awards by staying in a job. So if we look at, there was an attempt to establish regional fire centres across the country so that you wouldn't dial 999 into your 47, 49, however many there are fire stations, you dial it into a region, could save you a lot of money. They had 10 officers, 10 officials in charge of that project over a five-year period, so nobody was there long enough to see it through. And in the end, it was abandoned as too difficult job. Again, at a cost of £500 million. So all these things are big, big money. We always go for short-term fixes, and I have to plead guilty here. PFI, which I always used to think was a good thing to build our hospitals and our schools, actually, the asset value of all the PFI we've got at the moment is about £30-31 billion, and this government is carrying on with the PFI because it's the only way they think they can do capital projects without it coming onto the books. Over time, future generations are going to have to pay £150+ billion for these £30 billion of assets. And then we don't think about the unintended consequences of what we're doing. So, for example, you will hear Jeremy Hunt endlessly banging on about how we've got to get old people out of hospitals and into the community. Very sensible, both policy in principle and in practice, it would cut the costs of hospitals. But in fact, local authorities face probably the biggest financial cuts of anybody, with a third of their grant going. And nearly 40% of local authority budget goes on adult social care. So if you cut that budget, you inevitably cut their capability to deal with the bed blocking, and you get an unintended consequence. And I think one of the interesting thoughts I had to share this with you about what this means about our civil service. I think we should train people properly. I think we should leave them in the jobs for longer. I think we should have these bright graduates but just do more with them. But I also think that our system of responsibility and accountability needs revisiting. At the moment, the civil services is responsible to the executive, and the executive are then ministers answerable to Parliament. And this is built on the big old tradition, you'll know it all better than I, of having an independent civil service with those responsibilities clearly defined that can stand above the political fray. But when this system was really entrenched, let's take the Haldane report, the 1980 report, at that time there were just 28 civil servants in the Home Office. Today there are probably around, I mean you can't keep pace with the head count, but about 35,000, 34,000.
Oh,
and the idea that you can have civil servants accountable to ministers, accountable to Parliament, for that huge machinery is just a nonsense. Mm. And if you look at two recent events, Charles Clarke actually is interesting, because Charles Clarke, some of you may not remember, but he resigned from the Home Office because a policy over the foreign, migrants who didn't have the permission to stay or who hadn't been deported and they had a criminal record.
Had served a prison sentence and then were, instead, the judge had passed a sentence saying, and at the end of your sentence you should be deported.
And
somehow the file didn't have that written on it, and so people would be emptied out of prison,
yeah.
And the bit that said they should not be deported was never acted upon, and he ended up...
And he resigned.
Yeah.
But the interesting contrast is Theresa May, because when she got into trouble with over whether or not people were being properly vetted at the borders, Brodie Clark, her senior civil servant, took the fall for that,
yeah.
And she didn't. So there is in effect a change happening in practice, but nobody has challenged it in theory. I think the current settlement is impractical. I think it's frustrating to both ministers and civil servants. Ministers feel that they have to take responsibility all too often for things they didn't do wrong, and civil servants feel they can't tell the truth. They can't tell the truth to us to account for the way maybe a crass decision was taken by ministers which they were forced to implement. And I also think in today's world, where we're all demanding greater accountability, where we've got freedom of information requests around, and where we've even got the ombudsman that wasn't around at the time, actually, I just don't think the settlement works anymore. And I always think, I mean, I must give you my funny story. When I was a minister, my funniest thing about was I really responsible was when I was children's minister, and I was sorting out... CAFCAS, which is the support to the court service, children coming in care proceedings, and mainly in care proceedings. And it was a terrible mess, and we were completely reorganising. And I had to talk to Charlie Faulkner, who was at the MOJ at the time, about what we were going to do. So I get, we had decided at that point to get rid of the whole of the board that was running CAFCAS. And I got a memo up, and I will read it, a bit of it, from a civil servant. I have drafted about my conversation with Charlie Faulkner. I've drafted up a one page of what to say and what not to say. This sounds very Sir Humphrey, but you can say that again. But if there are any awkward direct questions, it's entirely open to Margaret to just say, that's a matter for you, Lord Faulkner. In fact, she might be wise to do so. Sympathetic nods are also appropriate. Interesting. And I see a good tune. So I was well and well truly told. Anyway, it's really a story. I haven't got the answer to this one, but I really think we should think about the whole issue of how we have accountability through Parliament to the public for actions taken on our behalf by both the executive and the civil service. In our little way, we're doing a little bit in the Public Accounts Committee, so I'll give you one instance of this. If a permanent secretary moves job, he or she ceases to have any responsibility for what happened in the previous department that they were head of. I wasn't having that. And we had the situation where we were looking at the Rural Payments Agency, which is the way of administering European subsidies to farmers. And we'd made a complete hash of it for 5 years, giving farmers the money too late, giving them the wrong amounts, having to send money back to Europe because we got it wrong. And when we looked at it, the person who had been responsible for this had had 5 years in the department, had just moved to the Home Office. So I thought, this is crazy, we're not going to ask the new perm set, we want her. So I asked her to come, she refused. I then asked her to come again a couple of times, she then refused. I finally ordered her to come, one of these new powers I find I have. She did come. If she'd refused to come, she'd have had to be sent to the Tower, which apparently is the only power that I do have. The only other thing before I talk a little bit about tax, am I going on too long?
No.
Is I think the challenges in the future for following the taxpayer's plan are immense. We're seeing a huge fragmentation of public services. We've got, if you think about what's happening to schools, with academies and preschools and those trusts, if you think about the NHS trusts and the fragmentation there, like NHS trusts are not responsible to the Department of Health, they are accountable to Parliament, which is crazy, to us through Parliament. And we have these endless hearings. We had one on maternity services this week where we were talking about, you know, we need more midwives. And when I said to the bunch of guys sitting in front of one woman sitting in front of us, who's responsible if we don't produce the midwives? There was a terrible silence. It was a really quite interesting. So accountability is much, much more difficult with the fragmentation. They're also government are abolishing the Audit Commission, which looks at local government. So we are going to be the only show in town looking at the whole of public services, which I also think needs great difficulties. And the National Audit Office will be the only administrative show in town that will be able to do an analysis to look at probity and value for money on behalf of the taxpayer. So I think that's a huge issue. The other big issue, where I was really pleased this week, I think we're making a few advances, is this government has chosen to put much more, we've started it, but they've carried it on, much more into the private sector delivering public services. And I don't think we should approach that ideologically. I mean, I'm not doing that in that way. But if that's what's going to happen, there and half of what the government now spends on services is now being provided through the public sector. Huge. If you're talking about 80, 90 billion pounds a year, it's a lot of money that's going out there. We need to be able to follow the taxpayer's plan. And all too often, these companies sit behind commercial confidentiality not to tell you what's happening. And the interesting bit of work that we're doing at the moment, which was part one, was this week with the four big private providers, quasi-monopoly providers. Next week, we're seeing the civil servants. Is I am determined to force transparency on this agenda. And I think if that's going to happen, we need to have open book accounting for the contracts they do in the public sector. We need to have the National Audit Office having the power to go in uninvited whenever there's a whistleblower or any concern. And we need freedom of information provisions to move into the private sector. Those are all difficult issues to work out the details on. I understand that. But if we are going to ensure proper accountability, that's what we should do. And what was interesting this week is that the four firms we short saw were happy to accept that. The only person I've asked the Prime Minister now three times whether he'd do that, he's turned me down every time. And so it's still a campaign on which I will work. Now, finally, a little bit about tax.
Yes.
tax is, I think, a central part of what we're about. Because on two grounds, first of all, we look at the effectiveness of HMRC, and it's a very difficult department to get a handle on. It doesn't have a minister in charge. That's its constitutional position. And confidentiality of taxpayers' interests makes it hugely complicated to try and get information from there. And the second thing is that actually, if we're looking at the round at public services and at the amount of money we spend there, we also have to look at the amount of money we fail to get in. Now, the tax gap, the gap between what we should get in, what is owing, and what we do, is huge. And in this year, it has grown. So despite all the best efforts of people working in HMRC, it is bigger. The HMRC figure is £35 billion. But that, if you talk to tax campaigners, they'll probably triple it. And certainly for me, it doesn't include the likes of Amazon, Google, and Starbucks, because they are deemed not to be legally obliged to pay any tax to the UK coffers. Although 25% of that £35 billion is actually money owing by big business. And if you look at the amount of money, graph it over time, that we're getting in from corporation tax, it is a declining figure. So we've got a big amount of them. And also, if you look at the government accounts, every year we write off £5 billion. Some of that is because people go bankrupt, but a lot of it is just because they think it's uncollectible. And there's another hidden item in the accounts, which is money they know they can't collect. It's about £10 billion, but they're too embarrassed to write it off. So that we're talking megabucks, and I think that makes it a hugely important issue. I'm going to regale with some stories, but we got into this because of the Goldman Sachs sweetheart deal. So we were having a session with HMRC on their annual report and accounts. And I got a watch of papers from whistleblowers. I have a real new, fantastic respect for whistleblowers who aren't properly protected and who do, you know, help me do my job much better. And my clerk said to me, you better look at it. And we'd had the head of tax up, and he'd said he'd had nothing to do with any deals with Goldman Sachs, completely denied any engagement with Goldman Sachs. And in this watch, which I looked at, was a piece of paper which were the minutes of a meeting held by the head of law in HMRC, which had looked at the Goldman Sachs deal and said that the head of tax had shaken hands on it, so had he misled Parliament, and that the deal was, in the words of the head of law, unconscionable. So that's pretty heavy stuff. So we then called the head of tax back, who kept saying, can't talk to you about this, it's confidentiality of taxpayers' interest. That was his way. So we then called the head of law, and we had this hysterical afternoon where he was sitting there obfuscating by saying he wants, telling us that HMRC was his client and he had no accountability to Parliament. Another interesting constitutional point. And I got a very good Tory who is in effect my vice chair, who's been on the committee for, you know, for 30 years or so, a long, long time. And he whispered to me, put him on oath. And I whispered back, I don't think I can do that. He said, yes, you can. So I then turned to the clerk whilst this guy was babbling on, saying, can I put him on oath? So he said, yes, you can. So I said, well, go and get a Bible. But the real funny thing of this was it took them 20 minutes to find a Bible. 20 minutes later, we put him on oath. It didn't really make much difference, although a month later, the head of tax chose to leave his job. But that really got us into this whole issue about the way in which high-worth individuals and big corporations choose whether or not to pay tax and how tax, particularly for the big corporations, not just become an option. I think for them it's become a new profit centre in the way that they can extend their profits. I always say this, this is not an anti-business agenda. It is a pro-fairness agenda. And it's not an anti-competition. I think it's just trying to ensure that we get a proper, fair level playing field in which everyone can compete. And if you think about that, when we started on Amazon, if Amazon can cut by not paying tax, can cut the price, I hope none of you buy from Amazon, I certainly have stopped that, but if Amazon cut the price by not paying tax of the goods they give to you, that damages, probably not here in Oxford, but in the rest of the country, it damages the community bookshop that can't compete. And interesting enough, it also damages the John Lewis's of this world, increasingly as Amazon is diversifying its offer. So we're talking about British businesses and British jobs that are being damaged by this global internet enterprise. And the other thing that I can't tell you, my postbag and my email has been filled with things, but stories from small businesses up and down the country who feel they are completely bullied and pursued by the tax authorities to the last penny. And yet they see these deals done, and they are deals done. They do deals with big business. Now, in an odd way, it may be right that that's the way we do the business, but let's at least have it open and accountable so that we get the feeling that everybody's paying a fair share according to their ability of pay, or according to the big corporations, the profits they make on the economic activity they undertake within this jurisdiction. And at the moment, that's not the case. And this whole issue has completely struck a chord. It's struck a chord in a way that none of the other issues we've dealt with has. And it's because people are finding it tough at the moment, because for 85% of us, we pay our PAYE and we don't have a choice. And it just offends. It just offends people's views. And what a lot of the businesses say to me are a number of things. One is they say we pay other taxes. So they pay payroll taxes and they pay business rates. But we all pay our council taxes and we all pay VAT. Probably we pay more VAT than we do income tax for a lot of people. And we don't think that that becomes an excuse not to pay your income tax. And the other argument, and this is where government does speak with forked tongue, is there really is a race to the bottom on tax. And the government just believes that unless they lower tax, they won't compete globally. And all I would say to that is, I think it's such a short-term view, because the moment we lower our tax, somebody else will. It does become the race to the bottom. Mm. So you just lose your income. And further, I think actually, I have no doubt for the big corporations, tax is an issue to which they have regard. But they will also be looking at things like the skills and the qualifications of the workforce. Can they employ people there? They'll be looking at Britain as a place where we're well placed in the time zone, where we speak the English language. And actually, that we're a good, pleasant, tolerant place to live and work. And those are all factors to which they have to regard, to which they will have regard. And I just think that we should actually have the guts to say we're not asking for crazy tax levels, but we're asking you to pay your fair contribution. I'm going to tell you a little bit. Am I going on?
No, I'm
going to tell you a little bit about some of the things we found out. We interviewed the Big Four accountancy firms. They make £2 billion a year from the tax advice that they give to people. And this is where, when people tell me we only obey the law, if the law were completely obvious and comprehensible, then you wouldn't have an army of accountants and lawyers advising people on how to avoid paying their tax. They make £2 billion. And there are two things about them. First of all, in the evidence they gave, or three things really, in the evidence they gave, they said that they will advise a company to adopt a particular strategy on tax if there is just a 50% chance that it won't be challenged by HMRC. So they're not selling copper-bottomed schemes to the companies and the individuals. they're selling schemes where there is a likelihood it won't be challenged. And because of the David and Goliath battle that we have between the tax authorities and these army advisors, the likelihood is HMRC will never catch up. On transfer pricing, which is one of the ways in which you export your profits to low-tax jurisdictions, the big four have 250 transfer pricing specialists. That's just in the big four. HMRC has 65 to deal with all advisors, all companies, and all applications for transfer pricing. So it's no wonder if you're not selling copper bottom, but only 50%, you're bound to get some wrong. The other thing that really got my goat, and I do go to the Lion's Den, I did a conference with tax people yesterday where I met the partner that we'd interviewed from KPMG. But KPMG, not on their own, I think others are probably equally as guilty, sent in an advisor to Treasury to look at a new tax relief called the patent box tax relief. And the purpose behind this is perfectly sensible. We're very good at inventing things, you here in Oxford. We're very bad at translating those into economic activity and jobs. And this was a tax relief to encourage more such activity. This guy, partnering KPMG, goes in and does the technical work to make that law work. No sooner did he finish that, 6 months on, he goes back to KPMG and produces a brochure saying, patent box, what's in it for you? And sells it at a tax avoidance scheme. And I feel particularly that we've got 1,078 tax reliefs in this country. I feel particularly about one, which Helena might remember, is a film tax relief, which we brought in. And we brought it in to encourage more film production here in the UK. You know, we think we're good at the creative industries and all that sort of stuff. Actually, the guy who advised us, who probably Helena knows, and I remember going to his offices and thinking, how can he afford all these fantastic original pictures? And he was, what he was doing was using that perfectly legitimate tax relief to a purpose that Parliament did not intend as a tax avoidance scheme, and made himself pretty rich on that. So that was the big four. The other one that, the other two things that I will talk about is the ones that Jimmy Carr, the rich individuals, the footballers. That was a fascinating session we did with them because we had a whole lot of, they're called boutique firms that provide advice to these individuals. And this one guy, I said to him, well, what's your business model? So he said, at least honest, he said, our business model is tax avoidance. So I thought, crumbs, what comes next? And what he basically did, he found a scheme, he got a lawyer, I haven't dared have the lawyers up because I think they're, but he got a lawyer, QC, to sign it off. And once he had that QC signature, he could go and market it. So I think the lawyers have got something to answer for. Yeah. Sorry, Helen. So he went and marketed. By the time HMRC caught up with him, he'd obviously sold it all around the place. And this guy had had six schemes in his, the life of his company, all of which had been closed down by HMRC. But he didn't care because he simply went on to the next one, which would be signed off by a lawyer. That was pretty awful. And then the final thing I'll say about the big companies. Literally, we've only looked at three, and we're not going to do any more because I want to be more systemic and broader looking. But the Google one in particular, I had to draw a map so that I could understand how Google was taking its money across borders, which I finally did. But I just genuinely still remain to be convinced that on the evidence we got from our whistleblowers, that the scheme that Google have is lawful. They claim to be not, they claim to be selling into Britain from Ireland and not selling in Britain. And that's at the heart of what makes them lawful, they claim lawful. Yet the evidence we got from the whistleblowers, including things like salary slips, which showed that over 50% of the earnings came from commission for sales, through to one guy who'd worked for Google for 4 years and had downloaded all his stuff when he left them, so we were able to look at everything, marketing, invoices, and the lot, says to me, they are selling here in Britain. And what is so riling is that HMRC have not yet litigated against any of these internet companies to test the law, which is not clear. and to see whether it's wrong or right. Now, I think there is action we should take. I think I welcome the government's attempts to get new international agreements to deal with the changing global economy. I welcome that. It'll take forever, and I think there's a lot we can do in the medium term. I think we have the most complicated tax code here in the UK. So simply, if you can simplify, Hong Kong tax code is this big, ours is about that big. So if you could simplify it, you'd have fewer schemes. But that is tough. I talked about 1,078 tax reliefs. If they are things like the film tax relief, the patent box tax relief, regional economic tax reliefs, they all have an intent. And if they've just become, we published a report yesterday actually on charitable tax relief, which showed as much went on tax to companies and individuals, tax relief, i.e. didn't go to charitable purposes, as went to charitable purposes. So, you know, it's become another vehicle, even charitable tax relief, it's become another vehicle for tax avoidance for companies and high-worth individuals. But if you get rid of them, if you get rid of those tax reliefs, you're left with the real problem. Government wants to do something in the economy, how does it do it? And if you had grant regimes, which is the obvious alternative, you're then left in the invidious position that government is choosing winners, which government is never very good at. So these are tough issues that we need to look at, but we should simplify. We should toughen up HMRC. Every pound we spend there gives us £9 back in money that we get from this great big tax cut. We should name and shame much more than we do. We should use the power of public procurement. So that if you want the taxpayer's pound to as profit to your company, you should only get it if you pay your fair share of tax on the profits you make on the economic activity you take in this jurisdiction. And finally, I think we should be much more transparent. I can't understand why we can't just try with a FTSE top 100. Whose accounts are anyway in the public domain, to say, actually, we'd like to see a little bit of the negotiation that takes place between HMRC and you on the tax due. You'll have seen Private Eye, another great thing, over the Vodafone deal. We don't know whether Vodafone should have paid $6 billion or $2 billion. We don't know why Vodafone was allowed 5 years to pay that money without any interest being charged, whereas any SME who gets time to pay back is charged interest over time on the money that we know. So I think open it up, and if people really don't want that, I think in the same way that we've got the Intelligence and Security Committee who are supposed to be looking after our security services, we could have a committee of both houses that oversees the work of HMRC. And I'll end on this. For me, tax is not just a legal issue, it is a moral issue. The accountants and lawyers hate it when I say this, but it is. We all make a compact, either as individuals or as members of organisations, to be part of society. And part of that is giving to the common purse for the common good, according to our views, whether it's as individuals or whether it's as businesses making money. I don't run away from that. Everybody benefits from what the public purse gives. The big businesses do, as well as the individuals and those vulnerable in our communities. And I think big corporations really get it. They've all got a CSR agenda, corporate social responsibility agenda. They worry a bit more about how they treat their staff. They worry about their supply chain on developing countries. They worry a little bit more about whether they're doing voluntary activity in their community. I think they should worry about whether they're paying a fair share of tax. And on that issue, I will continue campaigning until I really get a change, hopefully by the next general election. Thanks.
You were the perfect person for that job. Now, you must have questions. There must be people out there. Look. Can we get the microphones around? Okay. We're in the front row, then gentlemen there on the edge of this row in the middle.
One comment and one suggestion, actually, because I completely agree with what you said about the tax side. I'm a city analyst, and you know my speciality is advising the pension funds. And recently I had a meeting with one of them, who just said quite neutrally, you know, we're starting to really worry about any company as an investment where there's a really big gap between their tax rate and the standard tax rate in the country. And once you start to have that happening, you realise, gosh, you know, there is the mood now, it may be gone in 5 years' time, but where people are starting to think, actually something might happen. And I just thought that if you really want to, you know, get at companies, you have to get at the investors. And I think if you can start to talk to the pension fund trustees, some of whom aren't terribly knowledgeable and are terribly frightened, you know, they're quite defensive sometimes because they don't want to be sued. But, you know, they do have governments at the top of their agenda and have a big campaign with them, which is not a huge number of people, and say not only to the in-house pension funds, but the ones managed by other fund managers who live off them, be it hedge funds or whatever, you know, you might find that you get a further breakthrough. So, that's my comment.
Great. Very helpful. I'll let Margaret, you take a few and then Margaret can take it back. Gentleman with the red trousers.
You talked about the problems of accountability of executives and ministers. I wondered whether the recent changes to put ministers of the biggest departments in charge as chairing their departmental boards, whether the evidence suggests that's helping or hindering.
Good question. And there was somebody there.
Yes. So I have a question, which is that the concept of accountability to me is just hot air unless you have consequences. So these people who make the decisions to build aircraft carriers, to make deals with JP Morgan, et cetera, Fred Goodwin, Royal Bank of Scotland, there's no consequences from their decision. And consequences in terms of they're going to be hard consequences. They're going to lose their jobs, they're going to lose their pensions. Because in the private sector, if you mess up, you lose your job or your company goes bust. It seems the whole society in general here in the UK strikes me as there are no consequences. And the issue is I think for you as a politician and the rest of you, what are you going to do about it?
Are there more happens? I'm going to take two more questions and then are there somebody at the end of that row there?
Thank you for an interesting talk. I'd like to ask a rather general question. Looking back on your political career, do you think you were most successful in improving things for ordinary people during your three most productive years as leader of Islington Council, or during your three most productive years as a minister, or the last 3 years as chairman of the Public Accounts
Committee? That's a good question.
Just a final comment. I've heard you, I think you really, I admire the work of your committee, and I really like the second session with Google, Amazon, and what's name. But you repeated today something you said there, which at the end, you appealed to the morality of the having to pay tax. And I can accept that, but I think you went one step too far today. You said it's a moral question, not a legal question.
No,
I don't agree with that.
Yes,
it's a moral question and it's a legal question, because you can talk morals to the cows come home, but if you don't regulate it, they won't pay tax.
That's right. Can we have this gentleman here with his hand up and then we'll come back to Margaret?
Hi there. The question I had was, do you think that the short-term determinism and the short-term thinking that you mentioned is one of the major problems that we have, both in from a ministerial point of view, that then filters down through the civil servant point of view, which then filters down through the projects that we start, we begin, and then we think, oh, no, maybe not, or as probably happened with the Department of Defence, we were in the middle of Iraq and in the middle of Afghanistan thinking, oh, we've got to keep this going, we have to keep this maintained because we've got this commitment. And then we've got the financial breakdown in 2008, and then all of a sudden we don't have any money left. And so the commitments that we've got, the money that we've pledged, the contracts that we've signed, do you think that's a main, you know, so from the top down, the fact that people are only in for 5 years, either as a minister or even less if they're not very good at their job, or, you know, as we were saying before, in terms of responsibility as a civil servant, you're in for a couple of years and then, oh, actually, I want to progress, so I need to jump ship. Mm. How much do you think that is a factor? Mm.
Do you want to take that little crowd of
I mean, I think it's a very interesting thing about investors. I think reputation counts. Why did Starbucks come along and suddenly offer us £20 million in tax? Yeah. That was one of the funniest Christmas presents we had. But because Starbucks was much easier than the other two, you know, you could easily go to another coffee chain for your coffee. So I think reputation matters. And very interesting yesterday, this was when we did Serco and G4S have been in real trouble over the tagging contract and other contracts, as you've seen today in the papers. Serco's share price has gone down a third. So all these things, there are other ways of getting accountability, which are important. But I agree entirely with you about we need to bring in more people. On those I'll end up with what's most productive at the end, but on those issues about what's going better, what's going worse, those reforms creating departmental boards and non-executive members have really failed. They've not made any difference. And I don't know why. I can't be in it enough, but it just has not made any difference whatsoever. So, you know, it was an idea that hasn't worked, which is fine. You can try things and they don't work, but those have not added anything, I think, to... And in fact, I'm about to meet Lord Brown in a week or two to talk, because he chairs the non-exec directors, to see, get his view on it. On the issue about consequences for the decisions, I agree it's clearer in the private sector, actually, than it is in the... I can't remember who it was. It was somebody else, you were saying. I agree about your private sector. I mean, what was interesting yesterday, Serco's chief executive has gone, G4SC chief executive has gone, and Atos, I think. Anyway, out of the three, we had four companies in front of us, and literally we were scrabbling around for people to come and talk to us, because they've all been sacked the week before we're having our hearing. I wonder why. But
now it does seem to be better in the private sector, but as I said, I think the society in general has a major problem there, because there are many companies and you get the CEO, the sales have gone way down and they get the bonuses.
Yeah, your banks. But right. These guys who went also got Buck, what was this called, the guy around G4S, who was long hair, buck, I can't remember.
He
went with a nice little package.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
A nice big package, in fact.
government, I mean, you have, you know, yeah. the people who committed, yeah. Well, not just the aircraft cabins, I mean, just yeah. programs after programs.
Yeah.
And what they do, they either get promoted to be a minister, or in fact they go off to the private sector and get, you know, travel pay, and their life goes on beautiful. In the meantime, thousands and thousands of people are put out of jobs, disabled people are put out on the street, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah, I think it's a real issue, and we all put, you want to both reward and hold to account people, so reward for success, we're bad at that as well as holding to account for failure. Now, I mean, all I can say to you is actually a number of people, since we've been holding our hearings in this rather more open way, that's having a bit of an impact. We also bring people back, which never happened before, so we're going, you know, and even the fear of coming, we're looking at the way we deal with nuclear waste, which is a real terrible legacy from the 50s and the 60s, and it's appallingly badly handled, and the bill is just going up and up and up. And we looked at it about a year ago and made some recommendations, none of which have been adhered to. So they're coming back week after next, and that is quite a powerful vehicle for us. I think this government is trying to get better accountability in the civil service in the reforms they're putting through. And a number of permanent secretaries and, you know, I said to you, the head of tax left after the Goldman Sachs fiasco. left full stop. Somebody who ran the NHS IT, which was such a disaster, they left. So you see a little bit around the place. But, you know, I think we've got to look at both. This is all part of the bigger reform of the civil service, openness transparency and accountability, I think is key there. And then I agree entirely, it's a real, you know, all these are really interesting constitutional issues. We are very short-termist, it's completely bonkers. Actually, when I talked about that £8 billion of waste, some of them was decisions taken, and I shall forget it, I think it was on the typhoon by Mrs. T. So it goes back years and years and years before you see the impact. She'd ordered too many of us at Nerepin, we didn't need them. And, you know, that was part of the, it was some deal she did with the French and the Germans, I think it was the typhoon, I might have had that wrong. But, so they go often go back a long way. But for me, what short, you know, there are one or two people on the Conservative side that you can have, I mean, I think Frances Maud is really trying to look at reforms in a way cross-party, so that we can have a shared agenda, even on the reform of the civil service, getting the right skills in dealing with issues of accountability and responsibility. If we could only share that agenda, then actually you've got a better hope that you can really change the way in which we deliver services. And if you look at the Sure Start programme that we did, you know, you need a generation to see whether or not that is really having the impact on transforming life chances. The LSE people, the Roundtree people who are looking at that, said to me the other day, they're only just beginning to get the data through now on the early Sure Start programmes. We never give it time. So, you know, most of the Sure Starts are now destroyed from the original concept before we've had the chance to see whether or not they really achieve it. And universal credit is not a politically controversial issue. Putting six benefits into one, simplifying it, is a jolly good idea. But it's been, you know, we've probably raised 400 million so far, and Ian Duncan Smith is so determined to do it by this, you know, the end of this parliament. You won't have a sensible way of doing it, it'll make it last. So the whole area is how do we build a consensus while still having value-driven political parties that give the electorate a real choice between whom to vote for? And I think, you know, it's a whole other debate about political parties and people's lack of confidence. And it brings me to that final question, because when people say, what are you most proud of?
Which one improved the block from
voters? Okay, I was going to say I was most proud of beating the BNP, which is and kicking out. That was jolly productive.
Sorry, now, I'm not interested in which of those three periods in your career improved the lot of most ordinary people?
This one.
Why did it improve people's lots?
Because we have achieved changes. From the very little, let me just tell you, for example, we did a little study on the use, a lot of public services used 0845 numbers, which if you're using a mobile phone can cost you sort of 40-41p a minute. And by just shine a light, all my committee can do is shine a light and stimulate a debate. And on that little one, we have now got and a lot of the services were services for the most vulnerable, so all the sort of benefit services, for example, DWP, funeral services, all those things that you needed, you had to use an 0845 number. Those are being pushed out now. So on the small things at that, on the bigger things, I mean, I think we, even on universal credit, let's wait and see. I think we... You're shaking your head.
Well, don't worry whether he's shaking his head.
I'm trying to think of him. I think on that, I think on the way major projects are run, I think we're beginning to get a change. I think we are. And I think we'll have to have a debate. You'll have to tell me why you think I'm wrong. But I think we are, by a few of the little sort of Fabian-esque type initiatives I'm putting into effect, you know, small changes about getting people back, making previous term sex come and be accountable, all that, I think, is improving the quality.
Well, I would add that you and your committee have brought some sense of trust back into the government. So I think after 2008, the events after that, I think trust went out the window.
Yeah,
where I think we feel we have some voice through your committee. because everything you do affects most people. So I think it's that we feel our democracy is somewhat working.
That's a reassuring point, and probably on which to end. I have my one question I want to ask you. But it's just that I feel that one of the great madnesses of politics is, I'll give you an example, is the business of the PFI scheme, which was that was all about keeping things off the books, and as a result, we really are saddling future generations, our children's generation, with incredible debt that's going to come down the line and hit them in the head, full scale. It's one of the really disgraceful things that we bought into that idea, and I don't know what the answer is, because contracts were signed up with companies and so on, which are long into the future, but postponing debt, which will be there to be carried by a future generation.
I said it's an issue on which I changed my mind. And you look at the health service. I always think about this. We built these big hospitals. What are we doing now? We're completely reconfiguring healthcare. So it's all outside hospitals. We're saddled with these buildings that have, you've got to pay for 30 years. And we don't want to use them. So we're crazy. I'll leave you with this thought on it. I mean, we should just pay for what we should pay as we go. And one of the really interesting things, I've learned a lot in this job, but one of the interesting things, if you look at public expenditure around, we're not a big spender on the OECD league on public expenditure. We sit about in the middle of the table of countries on and what they spend on public expenditure. What we are is we're very low taxes. So we just don't tax enough. We're about fifth from the bottom. I might have that a bit wrong. We're about fifth from the bottom on tax. So we have never taken on the debate of what are people willing to pay for and how do they want to pay for it. And the reason we really end up in trouble with things like PFI is because we then find we haven't taxed enough to provide the services we think people want to improve their quality of their lives. And I think probably the answer to that is, if we just could have an open, much more open debate, which none of the parties really has the confidence to engage in, around tax and spend, we might end up in a more rational position.
Well, Mara, I thought that was a really stimulating, interesting talk. It was fantastic. And I want to join with the gentleman who spoke really last, because I do think that whenever you do research on this, people say that they're prepared to pay a significant tax as long as they feel it's fair and everybody's in it together. And one of the things that I think has happened that your committee has drawn attention to is the whole fact of there is too much unfairness, there is injustice, and that sense of injustice is actually, I think, energizing people to be much more conscious of how things are working. And I hope it makes for an electorate that are more demanding of what their political parties ought to be prepared to offer them. And I think that in itself has to be healthy for democracy. So I want to thank you, and I hope that you'll join me in the community.